Welcome one and all to the Stock Up Podcast, your one-stop shop for stocking up on the information you need to qualify for the Pro Tour. My name is Alex. I'm joined today by my co-host, Jacob Magro. How are you today, Jacob?
Pretty good. How are you, Alex?
I'm good. I managed somehow to play in 3 Final Fantasy pre-releases this weekend, which is a lot for me because after thinking about it, I've realized that the last time I played in a pre-release was Battle for Zendikar in 2015. So it's been a decade.
Yeah.
I'm guessing because we're doing the podcast and because I like Final Fantasy and because I moved recently and I've been playing a new game store that, I don't know, I just felt like playing and it was fun.
Nice.
What about you? What did you do this weekend? Any pre-release at all?
No, I didn't make it to any pre-releases. I took another trip to Colorado for my girlfriend's birthday this time, and we went to Meowwolf and spent a really long time there.
The Denver Meowwolf. I was wondering about that when my sister lives there. Is it cool?
Oh, it's very cool. If you go, you could spend all day there. We spent like 3.5 hours there, and we could have spent more time figuring stuff out.
Yeah, me and Jacob were originally from New Mexico. He still lives there. And in Santa Fe was the original Meowwolf, sort of this like immersive art exhibit type thing, kind of one of a kind experience as far as I know. It's really cool.
Yeah, I was way more impressed with the Denver. I've been to the Santa Fe one a couple times now, and the Denver one blew me away.
Nice.
Sure. Yeah.
I know the Santa Fe one has a problem where like it's not as nice as it used to be. Anyways, so for today's topic, we're going to be doing a map to the Pro Tour. This isn't so much how to get better at Magic, that's just what the podcast is for, but this is going to be the nuts and bolts of what tournaments you need to play in, how many points do you need to qualify for these different events. The way it's set up right now, there's 3 different routes to qualify for the Pro Tour. You can do it in paper, you can do it on Arena, of course, and then you could also still do it on Magic Online. They have the MOX, which is an 8-player tournament, and qualifying for the MOX also essentially qualifies you for the Pro Tours. So we're going to go through all those in all the gory details. I know that before I did this, I sort of wish someone laid this out for me. It makes it a lot easier. Before we get started, the PT, I just want to go over what the PT looks like these days. It's an invite-only tournament. They run 3 per year. First place gets $50,000, and everyone who shows up gets $500. So the prizes range quite a bit, but there's definitely pretty big stakes involved. Player size, it's, you know, I think in general between anywhere from 300 to 500 players, that sort of thing. Is that what you would say, Jacob?
Yeah, well, they recently kind of upped it this year. For the last couple years, I think they've been aiming for about 250, and I think they've upped that by about another 100. So I'd say about 350 is what I would expect now, which is a bit smaller than it was before COVID still.
Okay. Yeah. Well, it's definitely changed throughout the years. The thing with the Pro Tour is it's not like technically the highest level of competition. Like there's Worlds and they sometimes run some other tournaments occasionally that are higher stakes. But, you know, for players, that's really the benchmark of what you want to qualify for. It probably certainly more than 350 players are capable of qualifying for the Pro Tour. So it's always a fight getting there. It's not uncommon for really good players. I mean, I always had in the back of my mind the couple of years that Louis Scott Vargas, Hall of Famer, Paulo Vitor de Amorosa, Hall of Famer, they had years where they were silver pros and they couldn't qualify for Pro Tours. And I remember listening to them talk or reading their articles of how that struggle is real. And it's a tough game. You've been qualified the last few PTs, Jacob. What do you think about it? Is it been a breeze for you or what?
It's certainly, in my opinion, a lot easier to stay on once you're qualified than it is to get there, which was true before COVID too, but I think it's even more true now.
Yeah, that makes sense. It does seem, if anything, it's a little bit more confusing how to qualify for now.
Yeah, and I guess
one of the reasons I wanted to do this episode.
Even more simply, you know, it used to be if you wanted to qualify for without any pro clubs or, you know, long running things, it used to be you had to go 11-5 at a Pro Tour just to qualify for the next, and now it's 10-6, so even that is, you know, just a step easier.
Yeah, that's fair. Well, as far as I know, correct me if I'm wrong, pretty much every Pro Tour you've qualified for has been in paper, is that right? Or
except for my very first Pro Tour, which I qualified for with an online RPTQ, which actually, I don't know if you remember this, you lent me the deck on Magic Online. It was Bant Company.
I do remember that. Boy, that was a long time ago. See, I had forgotten. I was thinking your first time was your GP Top 8, but
Nope, that was right. I got my GP top favorite right after my first.
I'm remembering now. Well, I think you're more familiar with the paper map, so to speak, right now. You want to break that down for us, how you qualify?
Yeah, so I'd say the way most people qualify, maybe it's not a majority, but the greatest number, is through the RC system and the RCQs. So RCQs, you know, are stores that are events that LGSs, your local stores, get to host. They, depending on where you live, are going to range in difficulty by a lot. You know, here in Albuquerque, we have 8-person 2-slaughter RCQs sometimes. And so that means you just have to go 2-0 in an event, and, you know, anybody Lucky. Can do that.
I bet that's not that common, although I'm sure it happens at other places also.
Yeah, and then I've heard of some from my friends that, you know, on the East Coast or whatever, where they go to an RCQ and they play against multiple Pro Tour champions in the middle of their RCQ, you know, because the bigger they are, the stronger the players there's going to be, things like that. But anyways, they're all single or double invites, depending on if they're a premium store or not. The premium stores get them. Each store can host 3 a season, I think. They're pretty much required to either be a specific constructed format, depending on the season. For example, right now it's modern, or limited. And if it's limited, it has to be sealed. It can be a top, it'll be a top 8 cut draft. And my understanding is if it is exactly 8 people, you can skip right to the top 8 cut draft. I know, at least here in Albuquerque, as much as people like limited, you just get a lot more people, weirdly, I feel like, for the constructed ones. But it just depends, you know. But it's kind of like right now, I'm going to guess there's going to be a lot of Final Fantasy ones that might get a lot of interest that are limited. But as, you know, you're kind of later in formats for limited, I think those die down and you see a lot more constructed ones.
Well, Pro Tours in general have been sort of on a trajectory of having more constructed, because I think it just appeals to more people in general, like viewers and whatnot, even players.
I agree. I mean, it's just kind of cool to... It's a little bit of a creative process, I think, to build your constructed deck. Even if it's a known archetype, you still have a little bit of influence on it. And then from there, if you win one of those, you can qualify for an RC, which that depends on where you are in the world. Here in the United States, there's 2 per season. Right now, they're hosted by Star City Games. They're, I guess, they're always constructed. They are often the format that the RCQs that fed into them are, but I guess that's not true. They've changed sometimes. I think that's their goal, but they changed up the formats earlier this year or late last year, and that kind of shifted it all. You know, they're kind of weirdly phasing out Pioneer, even though now it's back on Arena, so they're probably going to want to phase it back in. Yeah, so they're typically 14 rounds, maybe they're 15 now, and that's kind of the really both common way for people to qualify, but it's really quite a funnel. It's a common complaint that, you know, you have to spike one of these events, essentially, to get onto the Pro Tour to start, and it's why I think there's a lot of great players right now. Pro Tour champions, Hall of Famers only get 1 invite a year instead of all of them, so oftentimes Hall of Famers aren't qualified. Just a lot less of people that you'd probably know their names. I don't really want to name them because it's a little rude. Yeah, they aren't qualified right now.
I don't think it would bother most people, but
yeah,
I get it. It's interesting. I mean, it keeps it exclusive. There's always this question, if as the game gets bigger, just in general, more people are going to be qualified to, you know, or be deserving of playing at the Pro Tour. So there's always the question of how much space you want to allow. It used to be the case that all the Hall of Famers, for instance, could go to every Pro Tour, and the Hall of Fame did every year, I think. So, I mean, that was not sustainable. They eventually had to slow that down, for example.
The Hall of Fame, as a side note, I agree with you. It wasn't sustainable. I think there are players, you know, like Javier Dominguez and Simon Nielsen come to mind as a big 2 that, you know, if the Hall of Fame was still going, they would be shoe-ins. They're amazing players with a lot of accomplishments. So it is kind of a shame sometimes that died down. And I think it was kind of maybe the inductees were happening too often, or the vote threshold was maybe too low.
Yeah, if they could go back in time, I imagine they would probably change the criteria to, first of all, do it less often, maybe every couple of years, and induct people and just have it be a bit stricter. Yeah, I mean, it's an interesting problem. I mean, lots of games have Hall of Fame, so they figure it out. But when your Pro Tour is limited to numbers, you can't really give out invites to all of them.
Yeah, and now it's 1 per year. So, you know, it would be cool if they brought it back, because it's a little bit more sustainable.
Yeah, that's true. I liked the Hall of Fame. I liked paying attention to it. I thought it was always pretty cool. It does feel weird that there's people that would qualify for it nowadays and just aren't on it. So I've never played in an RC. I have played in a couple RCQs. Obviously didn't win. But is an RC like a Pro Tour? Is it like a GP? Is it somewhere in between?
No, it's a lot closer to a Grand Prix. They're huge, and you know, not to downplay anybody's accomplishments winning an RCQ, but like I said, they can be pretty easy, even in some of the harder regions. I'm sure there's so many stores in those regions, I'm sure you can find some that are smaller. And you know, I really think that, you know, when you're talking about an 8 or 16 person tournament, you don't have to be the best player or even the top half of players there to win one of those, you know.
Right, you could just sort of get lucky on the day if you're decent.
And just generally, I think if you want to qualify for an RC, like almost no matter who you are out there, and you just practice a little and you play a decent amount of them, you'll qualify for an RC.
Okay, so it's not a huge barrier to entry.
Yeah, you have to do it, and you know, you'll get better practicing doing it anyways, so I would certainly encourage that. I wouldn't be scared to play RCQs, is kind of what I'm getting at. You could win one. You know, right. Whether or not you want to go to the RC afterwards is different. And there's so many of them nowadays, too. I think that kind of feeling that maybe you're going to waste your invite and somebody else should have gotten it, I don't think it's a huge deal. I wouldn't let that stop you from playing and even winning, if you're unsure if you're going to be able to go to the RC or not.
Gotcha. So also these days, since we don't have Grand Prix, that used to be sort of the catch-all premier Magic Open Tournament Magic event, I noticed that there's things called Magic Cons, Magic Spotlights. I haven't been to either of those. What are these sorts of events?
I would say a Magic Spotlight is essentially identical to a Grand Prix. It's just a different name. It's an open entry event. Not as often, you know. We used to have 3 or 4 Grand Prix a month. Now we're talking maybe less than a dozen Spotlights per year, but that might ramp up as the years go along. But still, they're open entry. We've even had, you know, I played one in Denver in April, Park Gear Limited, release weekend. It was awesome. I saw a lot of people that I hadn't seen in years show up to it because they love the idea of a limited Grand Prix. And if you top 8, you qualified for the Pro Tour, you know, very similar to what a Grand Prix used to be.
Okay. And Magic Cons, I've heard there's PTQs essentially at Magic Cons. Is that fundamentally different than a Spotlight? Is it sort of the same thing?
No, so, well, it was weird. The Magic Cons used to have these open events that also were basically a Grand Prix, but I guess they got rid of those. Maybe they just kind of replaced it with the Spotlights, and they said those can have their own dedicated weekends. So Magic Cons are just, A, where Pro Tours are at nowadays, and B, they have all these side events, including PTQs, usually 4 throughout the weekend, I think, on Friday, 2 on Friday and 2 on Saturday is typically how they're scheduled. Morning and mid-afternoon is probably when they start. They're limited, and you have to top 8 your sealed event, and then on Sunday you come back and you do a draft. And I want to say it might only be that you have to win the first round of your draft. It's like the top 4 get invites.
Interesting.
Yeah, so it's a little weird that you have to come back another day, but they're just kind of running all 4 PTQ top 8 drafts simultaneously, so it kind of makes sense, you know, just have the one draft caller and get maybe... I wouldn't be surprised if they have maybe stamped packs for that. I've never participated in those PTQs, to be honest, so I'm not sure exactly how it works.
Gotcha. So that's essentially the yellow brick road path to qualifying. RCQ, you go to an RCQ, you do well there, you go to an RC, you do well there, and then you're on the Pro Tour. Or maybe you play PTQ at one of these big Grand Prix type events. You could also chain together PTs. Is that how most of the pros have to do it these days?
Yeah, I mean, I know a lot of strong players that end up back in the PTQs or the RCs for sure. Effectively, how chaining PTs works nowadays is they have what's called adjusted match points. And every Pro Tour, you get basically your match points minus 9. And remember, it's 3 per win in adjusted match points. So it's basically claiming that once you get your 4th win or more, which means you made day 2 of that Pro Tour, it's worth it something towards qualifying for future Pro Tours. And from there, if you have 39 adjusted match points within the previous 3 Pro Tours that had happened, you're qualified for the next Pro Tour. For example, that's why I'm qualified for the next 2, actually, because at Pro Tour Modern Horizons 3, I went 11-5. So you take 11 minus 8, times 3, that's 24. And then I went 10-6 at Pro Tour Aetherdrift, which was worth another 21. So right now, just from those 2, which aren't even the previous 3, I have 45 adjusted match points. Now that doesn't count towards Worlds, because Pro Tour Modern Horizons 3 won't count towards Worlds. But that's why if you look back at my last 2 Pro Tours only, I'll have enough to qualify for the next one, which means no matter how well I do at the next one, even if you look back 3, I'll still have enough.
Okay. So there's no, in the past, they had like a level system and then they had pro points. So there's no silver, gold, platinum, anything. How do you feel about the new system and how they've changed it?
Yeah. I'm kind of okay with it. You know, it's kind of another name for pro points, but you only get them at pro tours is kind of how it feels. And I guess there's not pro club levels. There's just a clear threshold of how well you had to do in the last year. I like that it looks back a whole year. You know, Worlds is still kind of this weird starting point. And I didn't realize, you know, I played my first pro tour after COVID, like post-COVID, was Outlaws of Thunder Junction. So I've kind of only been back on the train for the last year. And I didn't realize till after that one that playing the first pro tour of the season greatly increases your chances of being able to play Worlds, because they're looking at specifically those three. But as far as playing future pro tours go, it doesn't really matter when you start your season. So that's kind of nice.
Mm-hmm. On one hand, I thought it was odd that you could just grind GPs, and if you're willing to just pay lots of money and travel to all the GPs, you could sort of assure yourself in a way pro tour invites.
I wouldn't call it assuring back then. You had to be still pretty good at the game. You know, you only had a certain number of slots. You had to put up some top finishes, not top eights. It's true that you could have qualified without any top eights, but that would have been pretty hard, I think.
Okay, that's true. But what I was going to say is, on the other hand, it was always really cool that one of the things about Grand Prix for a player who is not quite a pro, but who played a lot, was you got to see lots of players that maybe you liked reading their articles, or you liked watching them on coverage, or you liked their personalities. I mean, they were just all over the place. I don't know how that is now at these, you know, spotlights, but I assume it's probably less so that.
It's a little less, but, you know, there's always going to be players that have hot streaks, I think. It's just kind of inevitable with the amount of people you see. So we keep seeing that, and it's kind of nice that we see different players instead of maybe the same ones year after year. I mean, you still have these Hall of Fame caliber players and actual Hall of Fame players putting up those types of results. But, you know, like, for example, I know his Magic Online name. I'm forgetting his real name. His Magic Online name is Killa SUV. He won and got second at 2 RCs this year already.
Nice.
And that's pretty cool, you know?
Hmm. So now when you see him, he like pops out, you know,
yeah,
all the sea of people. Yeah. Yeah, that was always kind of a cool thing. Well, so that covers paper of how to qualify. The other way you could qualify is via arena. So they have something called the Arena Championships, and the top 16 of those get qualified for a PT, and the top two, so the finalists in those tournaments, go to Worlds. There's three of them per year, but you play from home. You get $30,000 for first, and everybody gets $1,000. So everyone who qualifies gets more than people who qualify for PTs do, but the first place isn't quite as high, and there's less players in general. I think in general there's less than 100. That being said, reading through this, I haven't actually, you know, I've never qualified for one of these, but it's almost kind of like they're trying to structure it as if this is the Arena Pro Tour. Is that kind of how you would think of it?
That's exactly how I would think of them. I have not played in any of these. I've played on a pro tour that was on Arena, basically the first pro tour of COVID, but that was quite a different thing.
Right.
I've
remember
never
that
played
one.
In these smaller field
it's
ones.
The
yeah,
last,
you played
last
it too,
pro
right?
tour I played in.
Yeah.
What do you think these are harder to qualify by your measurement?
Well, they must be by virtue of how few players there are.
Right,
and there's effectively the same amount each year.
Okay. I was thinking, like, you know, maybe better players lean more towards paper, so you might have more of an edge in that way.
Yeah, I would agree with that. I would say still, it's just, like, such a difference in quantity that it must be harder still. I think they're increasing the quantity, or at least they tried to and failed at the most recent qualifier weekend. They, like, said they were going to make all these changes, and then when the event actually went live, none of them were there. But they honored it in weird ways. Like, they gave people two extra wins on day one, effectively. So, like, after you got... Because they were supposed to give everybody one extra loss, and they didn't to make day two.
Okay, mess up there. Oh, well, things happen. So, just to break this down a little more concretely, the way that you qualify for these sort of arena PTs, which they call arena championships, is you have to qualify and play in a qualifier weekend, which they do these monthly. There's many different ways to qualify for them. You can qualify being in the top 250 in Mythic for that season. Really quick, how difficult is staying within the top 20, 250 in either constructed or limited in general.
It's probably fairly difficult. Just for reference, and this will probably answer your next question, I've played a decent amount of Arena, you know, limited for PT formats. I'll even play a lot, and then a lot of constructed too, just kind of for fun on my phone. It's really convenient. In the last few months, I've hit top 20, but I've not kind of made what felt like a grind to be top 250.
Okay. That's sort of been my experience as well. I've played a lot of Arena throughout the years. Even when I haven't been playing to like try to qualify for the Pro Tour, I'm still playing a lot of Arena. Season, essentially, or the last season, I guess, it technically rotated on Arena. I was playing Standard a lot because I really liked playing with this blue-black control deck. And I got within the 250 a couple times. Not like I was paying attention.
Yeah.
But I did notice that I was, like, in the hundreds, and then, like, I would take a couple days off, and I would come back, and I'd be, like, 800 or something, you know?
Yeah, I've been in the exact same boat. So, I'm just playing it a little too casually to try to stay there at the last day. I think you pretty much have to be, unless you're making it to, like, top maybe 50, you probably have to be playing on the last day and knowing you're probably top 200 even in the last few hours to really feel like you're going to secure that slot.
Yeah, and I'm sure a lot, like, I don't know the numbers, but I'm sure a lot of people play Arena nowadays, especially constructed.
Absolutely, yeah.
So, yeah, that does sound kind of rough. So that's one way you could do it. You could qualify via what they call qualifier weekend play-ins. These are, you can play they have, you know, Arena, they have different versions you can do. You can do the best of three, where you have to go 4-0. You can do the best of one, where you're afforded a loss, but you have to get six wins. These have buy-ins for 20 play-in points, which you get play-in points. Like, you'll get 20 play-in points if you finish outside of the top 250, but within the top 1200 of Mythic. Or you can get just a couple every time you event grind. Like, if you win a draft, however many wins in a draft, you'll get a few. Or, you know, this is Arena, and they love making their money, so you could just buy into these things for 4,000 gems.
Yeah, and it's worth noting, as someone that's played a lot of these play-ins for the qualifier weekends, that you don't get nothing if you come short. You can win your entry or more back. So, like, you kind of get some rebuys on trying to qualify. Mm-hmm. That's how I've played the last, I think, three qualifier weekends, maybe more.
Okay. And the play-ins aren't too tough, right? I've done a couple and usually got there.
Yeah. That's certainly
really trying and willing to buy in once or twice. So
yeah, obviously it costs money, but it's certainly the easiest way to play in these qualifier weekends by a lot, the least time consuming.
Yeah. And then a couple other ways you could also make day two of an Arena Open. I usually play all the Arena Opens, and I usually play enough. Like, rather it takes me one try or seven, I usually play enough to qualify for day two because I just like playing high stakes limited. So I'll get playing points that way. Like, I think I have playing points that I've not used on my account. Or if you do well in previous qualifier weekends, you'll also get an invitation to these play-ins. And then when you actually get to the qualifier weekend, you have to proceed to day two, you have to get 7 wins and 0 losses, which honestly is kind of insane.
I think your information is...
Is this not right?
That's not right, yeah.
For the actual qualifier weekend?
For the actual qualifier weekend, yeah. I think.
What is it?
It's like 7-2, but it was supposed to be... You can get one loss, and if you get your second before your seventh... But that was the mistake I was talking about. They were going to give you 3 losses before you have 7 to make
day 2. Oh, I see.
Yeah.
So it's like 7-1. You know, I was reading it, and on the article, they literally did not say...
How many losses?
That you could get any losses, so I assumed you just had to go 7-0.
Oh, yeah, no. Yeah, you have the right number of wins. Then that makes sense. The day two change is recent, too, because the webs, like, that one I assume they honored. The last week qualifier weekend in client did not tell you that you needed 4, although I thought it was 5 or something. But, you know, it was off by 1, but I assume they just honored it, given their website, and I know they're trying to grow that event.
Gotcha. Okay, so Jacob just corrected me. Day one, you can get 7 wins. You have to get 7 wins, and you can get 2 losses. So your third loss knocks you out. And then on day two, you have to get 4 wins, and you're allowed 1 loss. So, I mean, this doesn't sound terribly difficult, but, of course, you've already been filtered through a qualifier to get to this, so presumably everyone's pretty good who's playing.
Yeah, well, if you think about it like this, I think, you know, that means you could go 11-3 in the right order and still make it. And that's pretty similar to qualifying for a normal Pro Tour at an RC.
Right. Yeah, that's a good point.
Yeah, so it's about the same as an RC, it sounds like. You know, I think you could talk about the skill of the players on Arena versus that, but like you said, they both kind of have a little preliminary thing to get into it. And I think, you know, the weakest players will get weeded out at both those events pretty quickly. You're not going to play them for very long while you're still in contention. So it sounds pretty similar to qualifying for the Pro Tour via the RC.
I have played in these a couple times before, and I know the structure's been a little different, and I can't remember how exactly it was different. But I remember it being pretty hard. Although, I don't know how prepared I was, you know. It's pretty easy to kind of slack off and just with these and just sort of pick up a deck.
Yeah, I played one back in Bloomborough. There was a Bloomborough sealed qualifier weekend, and that's probably the best I've ever done. I don't remember exactly how many wins I got on day two. I think I was 2 wins shy at the time of what you needed.
Gotcha, yeah. It kind of feels like these arena championships, to be honest, are a little bit more of low-hanging fruit in the sense that like they're still hard to spike and qualify for, but I feel like I should be playing in more of these. They're pretty easy to just get on and play if you focus a little bit.
Yeah, you can play them from home, and you know, you have to wake up at a specific time. You have like a 2-hour window to sign up for the actual qualifier weekend itself, but you have a lot of ability to play. I guess actually they've shortened that. I think it's like a 10-hour window or something to play these matches, but you know, you can take some long breaks between them. You could take no breaks between them and get it done in a couple. You could probably day two in a couple of hours if you play a fast deck and you win.
Yeah, that is the nice thing about playing on Arena. That's one of the things I love about Arena Opens. I even like playing the sealed Arena Directs sometimes. It's just fun to play at your own pace.
Yeah, this is a little brag, but I won a collector booster box of Tarkir in 50 minutes.
Nice.
One of the last ones.
That's very fast.
Yeah.
So I played a lot of that. I won how many? I won 4 Tarkir booster boxes.
Nice, yeah.
But that was over the course of playing every day, a little bit every day for the weekend, you know? So I played several hours every day, you know? I did the most recent, the Ixalan one. I didn't want to play it really, but I was like, I'll do one. And I won a box with that, the one shot I gave. So that was pretty
nice.
Sweet. But yeah, anyways, humble brags. But yeah, I should be playing in more of these. I don't have like, I never know when they're coming up until I'm on Arena on the day that they're happening. And I'm like, oh.
Me too. And so because of that, I've told myself, and I've encouraged myself to do this by messaging one of my friends, Thaddeus, about it too, because I was talking to him about how easy it is to do this. And if you were just actually paying attention to it, you could even prepare for it a little bit. So I actually know when the next one is. That being said, it's the weekend after the Pro Tour, and it's historic. So it's not, if there was ever one I wasn't interested in playing, it's probably that one.
I should
But we'll see how I feel after the Pro Tour.
You should remind me, and I'll play in it.
Okay.
Man, it's been a while since I played Historic. I played a bit before the energy stuff got nerfed. The only two decks you could really play were like the energy deck or like Jeskai Control built to beat it with the energy cards also in the Jeskai Control deck.
Yeah. For those, I guess, that are paying attention to that, I have not tested at all for this format, but I've seen people talking about it, and I don't know, I know there's some, I think it's an Alenda 7-drop vampire that you can put in with the Sorin Impervious Bloodlord, the one that's banned in Pioneer. And
people
that,
used to
that
do
deck
that.
Sounds pretty good. So
okay, well, a little tip, look into that. Tough folks, if you're just starting. Well, so the third path here for qualifying for the Pro Tour is one for the dinosaurs. It's MTGO, Magic Online. Still up and kicking, huh? You play Magic Online at all still?
A little, to be honest. The most I actually play on Magic Online is, I guess, in preparation for the Pro Tour, but it's the single elimination draft queues, because I think it's just a good... It's almost all Pro Tour players before Pro Tour, I think, and it's just a really good
way
to get in good practice.
That's how I would do it.
You play in pod. Yeah, so that's most of my Magic Online is the weeks leading up to the... Like, I plan on doing that starting this week with Final Fantasy as well, getting back into it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, some weird things happen on Arena drafting because of the incentives, because it's so easy and it's a little bit more casual. In Dragons of Tarkir, for instance, I'm pretty sure Dragonstorm Orb is like a mythic, essentially, on Arena.
Yeah.
And probably not anywhere else.
And playing in pod, just really, you can't really feel like it's unfair what decks you get paired against. I mean, obviously some people open really powerful bombs or whatever, but... You know, if your deck is a little stronger, other people's decks are probably stronger. And if your deck is a little weaker, other people's decks are a little weaker. That's usually how it works if you're drafting correctly, I guess I would say.
Right. So MTGO essentially has RCQs. They have online RCQs where you play in them. They're entry events that cost 40 QPs. QPs yep. are just tokens you accumulate from playing, which it can be kind of tough to get up to 40 QPs, especially if you're splitting your time between Magic Line and Arena. But, you know, once you get 40 QPs, you play in these Swiss tournaments with a top eight. And then they have first and second gets an RC invite. They have ones called Super RCQs, which basically just means they're bigger and they give out invites all the way to fourth place.
Yeah, these are the hardest RCQs you'll play by a lot. But, you know, if you don't want to get a physical collection ready or leave your house, then, you know, they're there.
Yeah, or if you want to play in both. But it is definitely worth noting that they're going to be harder because so many more people, like in the same way Arena is easier to just log on and play, so many more people can log on and play. And also, most of the casual people that played Magic Online back in the day have all moved to Arena, so.
Yeah, it's certainly a really good way to get better at the game still is to play Magic Online. You know, you might hear some of the really strong players talk about leagues being noise or things like that, but it's still going to be pretty good practice. I would say, you know, even when I hit High Mythic on Arena is when I feel like I'm reaching the caliber of playing leagues on Magic Online. You know, it's...
Yeah, it's, that's been about my experience too. Because yeah. there's so many more casuals. I actually kind of wish Mythic was a little harder to get into, but that's neither here nor there. Let's see. I should play more Magic Online. I have a Mac that I use. I have like a high-powered Mac that does video editing and stuff. And Magic Online is not on Mac, so you have to run a another emulator type thing, which you have to pay for, which I do pay for. But then it's always an extra hurdle to get on a Magic Online, and it's really laggy and it's a pain in the ass. But I do want to play more Magic Online. So let's see. So you could do that. You could also, so Magic Online has its own sort of pro tour in a way. I mean, this is a lot different. This is almost like a Worlds type thing. They have the MOX, Magic Online Championships Showcase. It's only 8 players. The reason we're talking about it is because when you qualify for the MOX, you also essentially get invites to the Pro Tour. And so I'm just going to run through what the MOX is. It's another play from home tournament. It's, like I said, only 8 players, so it's a really nice tournament to qualify for because it's got a $50,000 prize pool. And with there's only 8 people, you're going to get a big portion of that, even if you do not very well. The way it works is they run like 2 pods of play, essentially. 1 limited, 1 constructed. Each win gets you more cumulative dollars. And each pod winner gets a Worlds invite as well. And the way to qualify for these is there's MOX qualifiers, which are 4 per season, which you qualify for those via Showcase Challenge or Last Chance Events, which are essentially open events, the same as a challenge where you pay 40 QPs to get in. The last chance, you also have to pay 30 tickets, but you only have to essentially go 5-0. There's MOX invite, or MOX opens, rather. And these are one of the ones that go directly to the Pro Tour as well. There's only 2 per season, but they're open tournaments online. They're 40 tickets, which is kind of like dollars, I'm sure. If you're going to play this, you've known Magic Online. But first place gets a MOX and a PT invite. And then they also do another thing off the MOX leaderboard, which you collect points from what I understand during the playoff rounds of some of these events, so during the top 8s, basically. And whoever has the top 2 players on the leaderboards get to go to the MOX and get a PT invite.
Yeah, so the easiest of those, if you're thinking about how to qualify for the Pro Tour Magic Online, I would say is the MOX Open, which is still going to be very hard, but it's just a tournament that you just have to pay attention to that limited format. You can just log on that weekend and sign up for it, and if you happen to win the whole thing, you know it'd be like winning a big PTQ, like a probably 400 to 500 person one, but still.
Right, and there's just not a lot of one shot tournaments anymore. Like pretty much,
yeah, exactly.
You saw as I was reading, you have to do this to qualify for this. You have to get enough QPs. If you just log on and forget that you only have 30 QPs instead of 40 or 15 playing points instead of 20 or whatever for Arena, it's a lot harder to find just one-shot tournaments. That being said, MOX Open's pretty tough.
Yeah, and you know, if you're getting into Magic Online to maybe play a format that, you know, isn't on Arena, or if you want to play Standard, and you're on Magic Online instead, that's cool too. But I'd pay attention to these showcase challenges and showcases because, you know, if you get the QPs and you're playing a lot of Modern or Legacy on Magic Online, or I think Standard and Vintage are the other two formats, you should, you know, try this to qualify for it. It's a super prestigious event. I think a lot of really strong players qualify for that, but I've seen, you know, there's still strong players, but I've seen more, I guess, format specialists often qualify for that too. You know, the type of people that I can tell they're just only playing Vintage on Magic Online, or they're only playing Modern on Magic Online, and they don't really play much other Magic than that, and they still make it there.
Mm-hmm. It is sort of, Magic Online's basically the home for Modern now, and I guess Legacy. But Modern's, yeah. Modern's gotten pretty popular for with casual people because it, since it doesn't rotate, and it's been around for a long time, and it's not, you know, it's very expensive to have a Modern deck, but honestly, nowadays, it's not that much more expensive than having a really nice Commander deck, so.
Yeah.
If you play a lot of Modern, if you've splurged for a Modern deck, you could look into Magic Online. You're going to have to buy a lot of the same cards again. It's going to be expensive. Won't be quite as much as paper, but, yeah. I have, just in our notes here, Jacob, pros and cons for each path. Some of them are kind of obvious, like the online ones. You get to play at home. It's a pretty big pro. What's a con you can think of for online tournaments?
Certainly on Magic Online, I just think it's probably the hardest path compared to either of the other two. It sounds like, honestly, qualifier weekends and RCs, they're pretty similar, it sounds like to me. And, you know, there's 12 arena or qualifier weekends a year compared to where you are in the world. There might only be 3 or 6 RCs a year. And also, you know, you have to pay to travel to those things. The arena championships, you can do all from home. So I guess there's less pros than cons, but I would say, honestly, the arena championship qualifier weekends might be the simplest and kind of best way to qualify. Now that they've made them a bit bigger too, I think it used to be a little bit more exclusive, but they've really opened it up. I think, you know, changing the amount of wins down by 2 is a lot, you know. That's like the difference between top 4ing a Grand Prix or top 16ing one.
Mm-hmm. It does look pretty nice, the more I look at it, I will say.
Yeah.
Something that came to mind is interesting. It's going to matter to some people and not to others. Paper, doing well at Paper Pro Tours has always had a lot of prestige to it, and I think it still does, from what I can tell. Arena Championships are kind of slow to, well, I don't know. I might be out of the loop. I just don't notice Arena Championships as much, and I don't notice the people that win them, and I don't notice the people that qualify for them. It's kind of an interesting...
Yeah, I think that's absolutely true. I often see a tweet about an arena championship the day of, and that's the first time I've even heard of it happening if I'm not super invested in it.
Mm-hmm. I would think a lot of the good players still play in it, you know. So it is a prestigious thing to qualify for in a way.
Yeah.
Maybe not, you know. That's something to think about. It's not the all the glory path if you're trying to get your name out there.
And either way, playing any of these, it's just going to be a great way to get stronger as a player.
That's definitely true. That's definitely true. We touched on the level of competition for the event. You'd probably rank probably MTGO the highest, and then Paper, and then Arena, or I guess Paper's a little more complicated. It's got the biggest spread.
Yeah, exactly. You know, the RCs are at least people that are already on the Pro Tour. There's a handful, but for the most part, they're not playing the RC that feeds into them. They can if they want, but, you know, they'd just be playing for money or trying to make top 2 for Worlds. Compared to on these Magic Online events, you know, invested players that are playing in the Pro Tour are going to try to qualify for the MOX 2 sometimes, and they're also going to try to qualify for the Arena Championship sometimes. So, like, the peak of the strongest players in the whole world, you actually will see less often than RC, I suppose.
Mm-hmm. If you were to play... I know you've played a variety of all these events. I guess you've never played in the MOX, you know, but you've played plenty of MTGO events that are...
Yeah, and I've played in Showcase stakes. Challenges and Opens. I've tried to, you know.
Yeah, and then you've played Lost for Arena, you've played tons of Paper, obviously. When you're building a deck for these tournaments, does your deck choice change based on how many players are going to be there, what types of players are going to be there, the competition for the event, anything like that?
No.
Do you think it should?
I don't think it should, like, really change that at all. I think you should just play a combination of a strong deck and something you're comfortable with. I mean, this is just true of all kind of tournaments that you want to win. I think I'm less in the camp that sometimes it's true that there's a clear deck you should play, but you know, right now it's a modern RCQ season. I can't talk to anyone that's going to say that there's a one clear best deck you should play. That was true a few months ago, I'd say, with Underworld Breach, to be fair. But right now, I think it's less clear-cut, but it's certainly a little clear-cut that there's, you know, we listed like a dozen or more on our first podcast, and I could see any of those being what actually is like the true best deck in Modern if you could know everything. But maybe outside that list, I think that's a lot less true.
Mm-hmm.
But I would certainly not try to like play a complete brew that often. You know, brews are fun, and if your goal is to have fun, you should play them. But if your goal is to win, I would probably be paying attention to deck lists from like Magic Online Challenges or bigger events if they're happening, like RCs, if the formats line up. Every week, every day even, I'd be looking at, you know, the recent lists. I use MTG Goldfish to look at recent deck lists and just try to stay in touch, because you'll notice these changes if you really pay attention to them. These things, there's shifts in the meta on Magic Online and people adapting in different ways. And I think so often I've played in RCQs especially, where I play against someone and their deck list is like from a paper event that happened like 2 months ago. And even though the format is still the same pool of cards, or maybe it's one set that had hardly any impact, things have changed a lot since then, always.
Yeah, you gotta stay on top of things for things to move so fast nowadays.
Yeah.
Information. One thing I will touch on that I thought of just based on what you were mentioning is you really got to respect the hive mind nowadays. Essentially, what Jacob is talking about when people, you know, when you don't want to play a brew very often, you kind of want to respect that the decks that are good have sort of been aggregatedly decided on that they're good because so many people have put in so many different hours over the course of so many different tournaments, and they've copied other people's decks and tried this and that, and then that's been filtered through people who lost doing some playing it one way and one playing another way. It doesn't make it, it's not such a fixed science that the best deck or the most popular deck is always the best deck, because there's other reasons that people play the best deck sometimes, because it's just because people play the most popular deck because it's popular, sometimes because of how it plays, sometimes it's because a certain pro player of a lot of status is championing it.
Absolutely.
But, you know, when you're picking a deck for a tournament, you definitely want to pick within the range of the decks that people have found viable for the most part, unless you're really expert and you know what you're doing. As for the deck choice per, like if I was playing in a Magic Online versus Arena versus Paper type of thing, I think I sort of agree with you that it shouldn't change much. Of course, the argument that people talk about is like, well, if I'm going to be at a small tournament, I might be able to predict what other people are going to play because of the size of the tournament.
That can certainly be true. All I would say, if you're going to make decisions like that, both with deck choices or card choices, is to still kind of stay within the confines of cards and decks that people play, if that makes sense.
So you don't want to play some narrow sideboard card that no one's ever played before, because maybe that's just not the rate. It's not an acceptable card for whatever format you're in, that sort of thing.
Right, exactly. But if you're playing, we'll use modern RCQs as an example. If you're playing Boros Energy and you think there's a lot of Amulet Titan at your local meta and you want to main deck a Blood Moon, a card that people play, yeah, that makes sense. You know, that's not a strange, bizarre thing to me to do. Or if you're playing Broodscale and you think there's a lot of Boros Energy and Prowess and you want to main deck a Dismember, that's cool. But if you're going to play some card that nobody ever plays in these decks and justify it's good in some matchup, that's just a bit nonsense. And even at a larger thing, if you're going to build if you think there's a lot of Amulet locally, I wouldn't build some 8 Blood Moon deck, because you're just going to lose to someone not playing Amulet, you know? Yeah.
Ponza from 8 years ago, yeah.
There's just little minor things you can be doing, and I would just say stay within the category of, you know, top decks that people play and category of powerful cards that people already play, is how I would put that for the most part.
Okay. So whenever you play in a Magic tournament, Obviously, you can't play in all of them all the time. There's monetary considerations. There's time considerations. Definitely seems like Arena is probably the easiest non-committal way to play. So that's a pretty good, you know, we'd probably recommend playing in that if you don't want to spend a lot of money or whatever. There's always this consideration when you're playing in paper events, like you have to travel to events. And a lot of the time, even if you do pretty above what you would expect, you still don't really like make your money back. You know, you're not like profiting on the weekend very often. I guess I'm just wondering, why do you find it worth it to like travel all these events, play the Pro Tour, if it's not going to like benefit you monetarily? And what do you think other people, like, at what level does a person have to be before they start thinking they should fly around and start trying to qualify for the Pro Tour?
Yeah, I mean, I would say it's never going to be a career. So, you know, focus on your job or whatever you do for money. And that's going to kind of, you know, be a deciding factor for if it's worth it to you or not. You know, can you afford to do this? I think I've been fortunate that I would say, you know, I don't think I've even broke even on, you know, the amount of money I've spent on traveling and on cards and things compared to the amount of money I've won in my lifetime. But that being said, I don't think it's also that far off. So probably close to breaking even is what I'd say. And the people who have won Pro Tours or whatever, then yeah, they're ahead. But that's such a small amount of people.
And even if they're ahead, I mean, like, they get $30,000 one year or whatever, they're probably not getting that every year.
Yeah.
So it's, you know, they're ahead by how much, really?
Yeah. I mean, there's not an easy way to put it besides that to some extent, you know, or not to some extent, it's just like a luxury. You know, it's a hobby that is costly compared to a lot of other hobbies, but it's a really, you know, people love Magic. It's just a super sweet game, and competing at it's awesome. And I find it so interesting that, you know, I try to watch so much. I watch so much Magic, and I see people, even at the highest level, still, I think, can be better. You know, and I'm not saying I'm better than them. You know, when you're actually put in those spots playing, it's hard to make everything perfect. But, you know, when you're actually watching as an outside perspective, I think it's a lot easier to notice when somebody did something wrong.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, the game is so complex, and you have to iterate so many different things over so many different chances under so many different circumstances that everyone can stand to do it better, essentially.
Yeah, and I'm a little off topic, but I try to give people more credit the later in the tournament it is, if that makes sense, because it's exhausting, too. You know,
watch your round nine, you're like, ah, why'd he make that play?
It's the win-and-ins. I've seen so many punts in people's win-and-ins for top eights of Pro Tours, and they still win and things like that. And it's funny because now I've gotten used to it. And it's like, you know what? That person is in their 16th round of Magic in the highest level of competition. They had a brain fart. It happens.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, the last Pro Tour I played in, I was pretty high in the standings, and it looked, I had a pretty easy path to top eight, actually, and I just sort of fell apart and fumbled. And I think I looked back, you know, I was frustrated at the time. I wasn't like angry or anything, you know, I've played a lot of Magic and lost plenty, but yeah, certainly frustrated because I had a good shot. And you know, for weeks after that, I thought about how I could have done certain things differently in deck building or playing, and there's definitely plenty of things, and it's possible Absolutely. That if it wasn't the end of the tournament that I might have done better, you know? So I definitely see what you're saying there.
Yeah, at Pro Tour Modern Horizons 3, I started 9-0, and I didn't make top 8, which, you know, I finished 11-5, and, you know, it was disappointing, but also a lot of people really tried to get me to talk about it being disappointed, I guess, and I wouldn't even put that in my top 5 most disappointing runs at Magic tournaments. You know, I still finished in 10th place. I was kind of ecstatic by the end, you know.
Right. Yeah, that's fair. Yeah, I think I finished like 18th or whatever. I was kind of disappointed, but that's just how Magic goes. I mean, I had seen a lot of people go like 9-0 at GPs and then not top 8, even friends, I think. So
I would say my most disappointing one was going 11-0 to 11-4. At a Grand Prix. So,
yeah, that's about as bad as it gets.
Yeah.
Yeah. Just so we cover everything structurally, in case people want to listen back to this podcast in the next over the next year or whatever, I'm going to cover what the World Championships is really quickly. So this is a tournament that's invite-only, of course. It's about 128 players, which is interesting because that's about the size of the Arena Championships. Obviously, this is much harder to qualify for. It's a $1 million prize pool, which is pretty cool that Magic's gotten to that point. First place gets $100,000. I imagine there's a lot of splitting that goes on at these tournaments behind the scenes, but I don't know that for sure.
Yeah, I know a little bit more about that, and I'd say it's probably less than you think.
Okay.
It's really annoying.
I would figure it depends.
Wizards is not going to do it for you. They'll let you do it if you talk about it and the weird... You know, if it's an honest split, it's pretty hard to mess it up if you're just like, let's split the money. And they don't care if you say that for the most part.
Mm-hmm.
They wouldn't want you to say it on camera, of course, and they still want you to play and try. That being said, the tax thing is super weird, especially when international things get involved, where it's so hard to actually make that like an even thing, to just the winner sending the second place person a bunch of money, because Wizards is not going to do it for you.
Gotcha. Yeah. It probably doesn't. Now that you mention that, it probably doesn't even happen that often then. People probably just play. But I'm sure it happens.
Yeah.
Anyways, last place gets $4,000. So if you have the chance of qualifying, Jacob, that's pretty sweet. Get $4,000, even if you are a sucker and don't do very well.
Yeah.
The players it pulls from for the 128, it's the top eight from the previous World Championship. It's the top 8 or 12 and 4 finishers from each PT for the year. It's the finalists from each RC, although that's only the first, I think, for some of the smaller countries' RCs. It's the MOX finalists get to go. And then the top 32 ranked players based on PT match points that are not already qualified, which we've talked about a little before. But
yeah, and you might know this answer better than I do. Last year, my understanding is there wasn't like a weird tiebreaker to qualify. I'm hoping that's the case this year. You know, if somebody who was 32th or the 32nd ranked player on match points that isn't already qualified, that's like the determining amount of match points for everyone else to have qualified. Now, that's not something they figure out to the last Pro Tour of the year. Also, for example, at the last round of Pro Tour Modern Horizons 3, which was the third Pro Tour of the year, my last round opponent told me, if I win this match, I might be qualified for Worlds, which was kind of a useless thing to say, but... You know, it was true. That being said, to make this a little bit nicer story, they lost that match and still qualified for Worlds. So
nice, good for them.
Yeah,
yeah. Well, so I read through today and yesterday preparing for this podcast. I read through all these articles that Wizards has, you know, and I didn't see anything about a tiebreaker. I might have glossed over it, but I don't know either. Doesn't matter too much to me.
Yeah.
But yeah.
Yeah, it might matter a lot to me, but it's so hard to know, because even this top 32 thing means it's just not something you're going to know till it's over.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I will say, at some point, I got to the point in my life where I thought I'd probably never try to play on the Pro Tour anymore. And the more I talk to you and do this podcast, I think I might be changing my mind. But, you know, it's no surprise, I guess. We'll see.
Yeah.
We'll see. But if, you know, if you're listening to this and you don't really think you want to qualify for the Pro Tour, it's no big deal. I mean, maybe you skipped this episode, so maybe this isn't that useful. But if for some reason you hear this, this podcast is going to cover competitive Magic, but I've loved competitive Magic for pretty much all the time that I've not been qualified for the Pro Tour. So if you don't really want to travel to events or whatever, it's no big deal. You could still listen. I think it'd be fun. And we're going to try to make it fun, even for not the spikiest of spikes. Just throwing that out there.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, getting better at something is fun, too, whether you want to be at the top of the competition or just, you know, hitting Mythic on Arena for the first time.
Yeah, totally. Yeah, we're not going to focus on it, but if you wanted to get better, even as a simple goal of trying to get to Mythic on Arena, this should definitely help you. Any final thoughts on the topic, Jacob?
No, not really. I guess... We went back to it earlier, but my thoughts on the PT kind of chaining, I kind of like it. I like that if you just went 8-8 at every Pro Tour ever, you would just keep playing them. That seems like a nice little baseline.
Yeah, I can kind of see that. I'm not really in that community, but I had sort of thought that maybe people were kind of upset that there was no pro point system or anything anymore. But I wasn't sure.
I guess I would say they are, but you got to remember that Magic is way bigger than it was before. So it just had to become more exclusive if they didn't want the Pro Tours to grow, you know, bigger and bigger.
Yeah. Yeah. And Magic players like to complain, as do I.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely.
Okay, well, that's going to do it for this one. folks. Thank you very much for listening. We have wrestled our Patreon back from the grasp of those who were holding it captive. So you can find us on Patreon. I set our payment the lowest I could possible, which was $1 a month. So if you want access to all our deck lists for deck techs in the future and Jacob's sideboarding guys and that sort of thing, you will have to pay $1 a month, but if you don't want to pay $1, that's totally fine too. You can find us on YouTube, you can find us on Apple Podcasts, anywhere else you listen to podcasts. At the moment, the Spotify, I'm still trying to figure out, it's somehow gotten linked to Patreon, so it's charging $1 a month, so I still need to fix that if you see that and that confuses you. But that's all for now, folks. Thanks for listening. We'll see you next time.
Thanks, everyone.
Okay, so I have a question based on the Final Fantasy pre-release I went to, which is a lot of fun.
Yeah.
Just see what you think about it. Maybe it's not even a question, it's more of a stream of thought. But so I went to the pre-release, I signed up for 3, Friday night, it was totally packed, and pre-registration was booked. I'd never seen so many people at this local game store, and I was thinking, man, how many people am I going to find where they are huge fans of Final Fantasy, and they've come to play Magic. And after being there for 3 days and talking to people, I've made friends with one of the workers, I've talked to the owner a bit, and I was actually talking to them about this. I didn't notice anyone who was like primarily a Final Fantasy player and secondarily came to play Magic. Pretty much everyone was fans of both, like regular Magic people that really like Final Fantasy, or in some cases, there was a lot of people I talked to who kind of had no idea what Final Fantasy was, but they liked Magic and they liked going to pre-releases, so they were there. And it made me think, you know, one of the ways Wizards sold us the Universes Beyond thing, I think, or one of the selling points was like, hey, maybe you have to have SpongeBob in your Commander decks, and you're going to have Spider-Man in Standard, and the cards are going to have this weird border, and they're going to be more expensive. But hey, this is growing Magic. There's going to be lots more Magic players. One thing I kind of have thought after this weekend is, what if the people that we're bringing in for Universes Beyond are just, like, they come here to buy all the Final Fantasy product, and they make it really expensive. You know, you got $100 Sephiroths and $80 VBs or whatever. But then they don't actually convert into Magic players. They just, like, for instance, I have a friend who's already asked me, because he knows I deal with so many Magic and I have an eBay store and all that, he's asked me to get him some Final Fantasy cards, and he has no interest in playing Magic. So, just sort of curious what you think about all that. I know you didn't play in a pre-release.
Yeah, but I've played a lot of pre-releases in the last year, especially.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I'd say it's growing the game, but a lot of it is not going to be the competitive players of the game, these Universes mm-hmm. Beyond. I think it's a little bit of a different category of players. I know Lord of the Rings previously was the best-selling set of all time, and now I know Final Fantasy on pre-order was the best-selling set of all time.
Mm-hmm.
So obviously it's very successful. That breaking, you know, best-selling set of all time, that can't all just be people who just want the cards to look at them.
No. I don't think so.
It's probably growing the game. You know, my uncle is an example of someone that, you know, he played back in the 90s and hardly has played for decades. He's a huge Lord of the Rings fan, and now he plays Commander every week with his friends. Since Lord of the Rings came out, you know.
Okay. Yeah. It'll be interesting to see if that happens for Final Fantasy. I mean, I run an eBay store where I sell lots of primarily Pokemon, and it's pretty much all collectors I sell to. So I wouldn't underestimate how certain IPs can draw people to just want to buy the cards, especially since Magic cards look a lot cooler than they used to.
I agree with that, having worked in a game store myself, and Pokemon players seem like they almost primarily did not play the game, and they were buying Pokemon.
Yeah, I think it's like 90% to 10. And then I heard a stat recently that seems to be legit, where from Wizards, where I think that something estimates of like 90% of people who buy Magic cards play either on Kitchen Table or EDH.
Yeah, I absolutely think that's true.
That sounds about right. It's a different landscape. I'm not exactly, in a way this might sound like I'm being negative, I'm more just kind of making an observation. Like, for example, I had a lot of fun this weekend. I think the set's really cool, and even though I haven't played in a pre-release in a long time, I thought it was a lot of fun. I like this set. Just something to take note of as we go into this new world with Spider-Man, and who else knows what's to come.
Yeah, I think I just don't mind Universes Beyond at all, on like the same level that I think some people dislike it. It's a little goofy at times, but sometimes normal Magic cards are a little goofy. The last year especially, I guess, has been that way. Not that I'm saying I think it's bad. I don't mind that the game's a little goofy.
A new world, for sure. We will see how it goes.